Okay, thank you. So the first thing to note is just simply that you all didn't actually have to come and hear my talk because it's on the web. So what I'd like to do is just to give a talk aimed towards the median sort of attendant at this conference, and so the strengthiest in the audience should go do something else because they're going to be extremely bored by this. So I just want to start off by talking a little about the context. String theory, of course, was born as a model of hadrons, but there was this embarrassing massless spin 2 state in the spectrum that meant that it didn't turn out to be a very good theory of QCD, but it turned out to be great for unifying gravity in the standard model, talking about issues of black hole entropy and the information problem, which is what gets me interested. Other people have studied things feeding into this big animal that we now call string theory, from looking at gauge dynamics, supersymmetric gauge theories, non-perturbative. Other people studied classical supergravity, p-brainology. We put together this diagram which linked together all of the five perturbative string theories in an 11-dimensional theory. We've also studied various other hot topics over the last few years. There's a strong interaction with mathematics. But what we really want, of course, is to build models of the low-NG world as well as understand quantum gravity. Our understanding of the full theory is incomplete, and I like to, you know, do a cartoon that string theorists currently are just basically playing around in their playpen, and the fact that this has six sides is entirely deliberate as relates to this diagram up here. So since I have to get this done very quickly, I have to talk very fast. But I'd like to mention that when we play around in our playpen, what are the kinds of Lego blocks that we're playing with? Well, the most basic building blocks that we have available in string theory are basically perturbative things in the perturbative spectrum of string theory and things in the non-perturbative spectrum. The perturbative ones are just the fundamental, usually superstrings. They have a fundamental length scale, L string, which describes, at least for a low energy string, the typical extent of the thing. There are open strings and there are closed strings. If you do the quantum mechanics of these things, propagating in a mostly flat space, you find that the ground state of the open string is a spin 1 gauge field, and the ground state of the closed string is a spin 2 thing, which is the graviton. Now, the fact that you get spin 1 here is not entirely surprising. You might imagine that if you put two of these guys sort of together and you join them up, you would get a closed string, and so that corresponds to sort of tensoring together a couple of spin 1s to get a spin 2, and that's very roughly right. So not only are there the ground states, though, with these strings, there's also an infinite tau of excitations of increasing mass and spin. And, of course, these strings actually interact. And the coupling constant G string is the thing that describes this basic vertex here for open strings. It's a square root of that, roughly speaking. And there are also not just the things in the perturbative spectrum, but the non-perturbative spectrum. There are the D-brains, which are, for the given P here, a p-dimensional hypersurface where the open strings end. At least perturbatively, this is a correct picture. And the fact that the endpoints actually have to be on these D-brains, at least in the type 2 string theories, means that the gauge theory that you get, the theory corresponding to the ground states, in other words, the low-energy physics of these open string modes, that gauge theory has to be stuck on the D-brains. So you naturally get a mechanism for having gauge theories and things of spin 1 or less stuck on hypersurfaces while the gravity propagates everywhere in the big dimensional space-time. The gauge coupling of these gauge theories is a derived quantity in the sense that the Yang-Mills coupling squared is built out of the coupling constant up here, this basic coupling parameter in string theory, and also enough powers of that basic length scale to make the dimensions right. The Newman constant is also a derived quantity. It's not itself a fundamental property of string theory, if you like, but you can derive it by looking at scattering amplitudes for closed strings, and you find that it goes like 2 powers of the basic string coupling constant plus enough powers to make the dimensions right. Now, we're all used to the fact that in relativity, matter tells space how to curve, and space tells matter how to move. In string theory, there's a sort of a very subtle self-consistency because matter and gravity are all part of the same bundle. So there is the fact that strings not only determine the background that they move in, but they sort of move in response to that background. So you can imagine that there's quite a highly constrained set of equations for string theory, and that's why only some geometries are allowed. Now, from the point of view of asking what is the low-energy physics, you find that there is typically Einstein gravity plus other fields. But if you're interested in what is the quantum corrections to that picture of just general relativity plus what you might call matter fields or quantum field theory stuff, There's string corrections, the fact that the strings are actually not point particles, and then there are also the loop corrections. So over the last few years, we've been making a bunch of discoveries in string theory. Do I have the timer? One of the ways that we've been making discoveries is by taking parameters to extremes. And you might expect that in general, if you take parameters to extremes, you would get singular stuff. But in fact, that's not what happened, and this is a very interesting fact. So, for example, if you take the coupling constant, this basic thing, to infinity for the type 2A string theory, you grow an extra dimension. You don't all of a sudden get a theory that's completely out of control. You know how to study this, at least in some limits. Another example is that if you take a bunch of D-grains, and you take the stringiness parameter to zero, but you hold that gauge coupling fixed, you get these highly non-trivial gravity gauge correspondences. Also, if you take the stringiness parameter to zero while you hold fixed a B-field, this is sort of like a gauge potential, but it's got two legs instead of one, you get non-commutative quantum field theories, or other kinds of theories, which have been a focus of a lot of interest recently. But one of the ones that's more interesting, I guess, in the context of the relation to people who are interested in gravity is these gravity gauge correspondences, like, for example, the ADS-CFT correspondence, which actually give a realization of the idea of the holographic principle, which personally I prefer to call a conjecture. It's a specific example where a higher dimensional gravitational theory is equivalent to a lower dimensional gauge theory. It's a strong weak duality in the sense that when something over here is classical, that one is very quantum mechanical, and vice versa. But what this gives us, other than a huge amount to explore, and there's a lot of really beautiful physics in this, but it gives us the quantum gravity context in which to explore some of the puzzles that concern black hole people. And one of them is the black hole information problem. Now, if you believe that this duality is exact, and you know, we hope that one day we'll be smart enough to actually derive it from something like a path integral, it gives an in-principle resolution of the black hole information problem. The only questions I'd like to postpone those to the question part, but also it gives a method for understanding, in some cases, resolution of space-time singularities. And that's basically the application that I want to concentrate on. Now, in string theory, or N theory, this is the thing that's this 11-dimensional animal, classically speaking, you get supergravity. That's sort of like a super version of plain old Einstein gravity with a bunch of other fields in the spectrum. And if you study this theory and you look for solutions, you find that you get both closed singularities, closed ones rather, that these can be space-like, null, or time-like, all of the things happen, and you also, if you naively follow your nose, also get naked singularities. This is what happens in classical string or N theory. Now, the expectation that you might always hear is that quantum string theory can fix singularities in one basic way, and is that it smooths the singularities out. If you've got some disgusting, nasty point singularity here, you imagine that some stringy degrees of freedom will sort of, you know, blob it out and make it into some, you know, strongly coupled region, but at least there's no mathematical point singularity. And the idea is that space-time is losing meaning when the curvatures get too big in units of that basic string scale, other degrees of freedom take over. But there is another thing which can happen, and this was first emphasized in an important paper by Horowitz and Polchinski, and that is that string theory can actually prevent these things from ever happening in the first place. The canonical example here would be a negative mass, just regular old Schwarzschild geometry. Here, of course, there is a singularity at r equals zero, and normally if you had a positive mass, then it would be closed by a horizon that would happen at a certain radius. And that would be nice and fine. You would just imagine maybe string theory will do something of this kind in the middle of a space-time. But if you have a negative mass, then the horizon is gone, and you just have a point singularity. Now, a string theory would somehow take that point singularity and spread it out into a blob, then what you would have would be an object which is big and relatively big and stable, and overall it has negative mass. But that would mean that the vacuum would then be unstable into falling apart into gazillions of these blobs. And that's really unacceptable. So what must happen somehow is that if you were to imagine that such a classical geometry might somehow arise in some system, then there must be some physics that prevents it from ever forming in the first place. Like if you tried to smash things together to make it, it would never happen. So there are some geometries which don't just get patched up, but they're actually figments of a classical physicist imagination. They just never happen. And so string theory should be able to tell us one way or the other how these things happen. Now, I was hoping to get to an example, but let me just talk about some of the properties of string theory that might fix this up. How does string theory actually get to providing mechanisms for resolving singularities? And one of the basic properties of string theory is that there are scattering amplitudes in the theory that you can compute, and they are different at high energy from amplitudes that you compute in field theory or for point particles. For example, if you have a string, and it does matter which guy you pick for this sort of thing, but you might imagine that as you up the momentum of the probe, then the position space resolution that you get gets better and better. But in fact, what you find is once you get past a certain momentum, which is essentially the inverse of the string scale, then you start to get a term which grows again. So your resolution somehow got minimized, and then it went to hell again as you increased the energy. Now, at higher energy then, we seem to be losing out, and it's actually relatively easy to understand the physics that goes into this. The basic physics is simply that if you pump too much momentum into your little string, that's the guy that you're trying to do the resolution with, then the extra energy just goes into stretching the string. So the thing that you're trying to probe with is no longer a point particle, it gets big. And so that means that there is effectively a minimum distance that you can probe here. So there's no meaning to a distance that's smaller than that string scale. I'll just mention, though, that if you probe with different objects, for example, with a D0 brain, then you actually see different minimum distances. These are different, essentially, because these guys, well, first of all, they're different animals, but they also couple to different fields, and they scatter in different ways. And lastly, I'll just, I guess, mention that string theory typically has black holes in it. And one of the things that we know about a system, if you sort of crash things together with a very big center of mass energy, if you have enough energy, then the Schwarzschild radius is going to be an important quantity here. And the black hole will form, and then you'll have to be concerned about this physics. So this is another indication that in string theory, sometimes if you make the energy go up, it's not that the distances you're talking about get smaller and smaller, but in fact the distances that are relevant to the physics actually go up. I didn't get to mentioning the enhancer, but my time is up. Okay, I'm not sure if I completely understood the question, but I think what you're asking is if you are far away from the black hole, then does it look the same in string theory as it does in general relativity? Was that the question? Right, yeah, generally the behavior of the spacetime would still look the same at infinity, because that how that spacetime behaves determines the ADM mass. And in string theory, you want to produce the thing that still gives rise to the same quantum numbers. But what would happen when you would get right down into the middle of the singularity in the geometry? So say you were dumb enough to fall into a black hole, then the question of exactly how the dynamics would transpire right in the middle there would be different. That's about all I can say, given the limited time that I have, but we can discuss it afterwards, what other differences might arise. Yeah. You're not supposed to ask questions, you're a string theorist. Is this a plant? How does the classical Repulson singularity get resolved? Well, that's my next transparency. A Repulson singularity is a thing that arises in certain geometries that you try and make in classical string theory, and it's called the Repulson not just because it's nasty, because it has a naked singularity and that's disgusting in general, but because also that if you fire a massive particle at it, it gets repelled. And for certain special systems, especially ones with enhanced supersymmetry, you can find mechanisms that give rise to the resolution of these singularities. And the one I would have talked about if I had time essentially is related to this this phenomenon occurring here, but just dressed up in different dual clothing. So